Hey, from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm John Trumbull, Rush chairman. Damn glad to meet
you.
Whoa!
Oh, I see what you did
there.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You switched it up there, fella.
That's right.
Nice.
That's right. And
oh,
in special recognition of the special movie that we are doing this week.
Yeah, we're diving right into it. No, we're not going to...
No, we can do the preliminaries. I just wanted to do my intro.
Oh, okay.
That.
I didn't know if you want to ramble because, like, you know, for those that know about last week's episode, we went a little long and like that
just a touch,
just a skosh.
We went so long. I think we're still recording that episode.
Yes. We're talking about MacGruber.
Yeah.
2010. Yeah. I mean, in my defense, that movie had a lot more to talk about than most of the other SNL movies were talked about.
For the record, I blame you for that.
Yeah.
Entirely.
All over here. Wow, you're just right under the bus.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, no brotherhood in the... No loyalty in the SNL brotherhood.
All right. Not at all.
Fine. That's good.
I mean, do you deny this?
No.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a lot to talk about. Like,
I mean,
with all the other SNL movies we've watched, we were very indifferent to them because the jokes were whatever and the plot was whatever.
Yeah.
But with MacGruber, the jokes were very strong and the plot was pretty strong. There was just more to work with.
We went longer than the actual movie.
We did.
Yeah, we went longer than the movie by, I think, about 20 minutes.
We did. My God. Like, I felt it. Like, at a point, I was like, at one point, I was like, yeah, we need to wrap this up. We definitely went over.
I listened to the episode because you want to be aware of how you're coming off and improve in areas where you can.
Indeed.
And I listened to that, and at a certain point I was like, yeah, I'm sick of this now.
Yeah, a little of us goes a long way. I'll admit that.
That is true.
So that's why we're going to dive right into today's movie that we're going to talk about, which I guess, would you say this is like the first SNL movie, technically, maybe?
I think you could qualify it as an SNL movie because it stars one of the big stars of SNL.
Right, of course. This was like him at his height.
This was John Belushi in National Lampoon's Animal House.
Yes, came out July 28th, 1978.
Yes.
Directed by John Landis, who directed Blues Brothers, written by Harold Ramis, Chris Miller, and Doug Kenny.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, we've talked about Doug Kenny briefly at the... Mm-hmm. Stupid and Futile Gesture movie, the one that came out on Netflix.
Yeah.
From what I found, this movie was had a budget of $3 million, grossed $141 million.
Successful movie.
I would say so.
Successful
wow.
movie.
This broke all types of box.
And that's
office.
$1978 dollars.
Yeah, that's like, you could buy a country with that.
That is like, I haven't done the conversion, but I think it is like $10 billion in today's money.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
We're not math majors, but that sounds right.
Right, right.
Like,
you, as I said, I'm doing the conversion. I haven't done the conversion. You looked down at the keyboard and you were like, is he going to fuck up with the keyboard again? You took a glance down at the keyboard. You were like, don't go for the keyboard. Keyboard, Trumbull.
It's like, no, we did this before. We went through this.
Yeah.
Unplug that thing if you really got to go for it. But please, come on, man. Come on, bro.
I just saw that moment of fear in your face.
A trickle of sweat.
Yeah.
From my brow.
Yeah, it was just like that one trickle of sweat going down like the guy in Total Recall.
Yeah. Like, don't do it.
Yeah.
But this movie was a huge blockbuster. This was, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I mean, what we said, Belushi was in. I would say this is the movie that launched Belushi, if anything. I mean, he was already on the rise, but like this one.
I mean, he was like the only known person in the cast when they did the movie, because he'd already had a couple seasons of SNL under his belt.
Right.
And but they originally wanted to cast it with even more people from Saturday Night Live. Did you hear about this?
I did not hear about this.
Okay.
Did you know about this? Did you hear about this?
Did you hear about this? Did you know about this? So they are originally, there was discussion they were going to have Dan Aykroyd as D-Day.
Okay.
The Bruce McGill part, the motorcycle riding guy. It was kind of based on Aykroyd because Aykroyd's a big gearhead.
I could see that. All right.
They were talking about Chevy Chase as Otter.
I could definitely see
the
that.
The ladies' man.
Yeah, the
guy.
Poon hound, I would say.
And then Boone, they were talking about Bill Murray.
All right. Okay.
But it turns out Belushi was the only one who was really interested in it. And
really? The other guys were just whatever?
Well, Aykroyd, I think, could have been in the movie, but Lorne Michaels didn't want to lose two of his stars to the movie.
Hmm.
So he said, I will fire you if you take this movie.
Oh,
he let Belushi go and do the movie, but he did not want to let Aykroyd go too, because those were like the two big guys.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But
at the
time, I didn't know like Michaels was dropping a hammer like that.
Yeah, you know,
Taskmaster.
Michaels, he can play hardball.
Apparently, yeah.
And
I mean, Chris Kattan knows that.
And there was a really interesting story where I get the feeling that John Landis didn't really particularly want Chevy Chase in the movie.
Why is that? Because he's
Chevy Chase.
Again, we will talk more about this in our Chevy Chase episode, which may or may not ever happen.
We may do someday. I think the main reason is that Landis didn't want it to be like an SNL movie with half the SNL cast.
Oh, he wanted it to be his own thing.
He wanted like straight dramatic actors and unknowns in the movie.
Yeah, I guess I could see that.
Cuz then you're believing the characters more, and I see where he was coming from.
Oh, instead of this is just Bill Murray playing a part. This
right.
is the guy.
Right.
I get it.
You would believe in the reality of the movie a little bit less, I think.
Okay,
if it was half SNL people.
Hmm.
Oh, and he wanted they were originally talking about Brian Doyle Murray as
Dean?
As the James Widow's part, Hoover.
Oh, Hoover, yeah.
As the president of the fraternity.
Gotcha.
So
I could see that.
And in an interesting story, John Landis, he had a meeting with Chevy Chase about it, and Chevy Chase was trying to decide if he was going to be in this or in Foul Play, which was a starring role.
Mm.
It was a movie he did with Goldie Hawn. I've never seen it.
But I've heard of it. I haven't seen it either, but I've heard of it.
But that was when, like, you know, Chevy Chase was doing his first big push to be a big
right.
movie star.
Leading man.
And John Landis said something very shrewd to him. He was like, well, I mean, in this movie, you'd be part of an ensemble like Saturday Night Live. And in Foul Play, you're the leading man. That's all on your shoulders. I mean, that's... And so he was like doing this in the guise of trying to sell it to him, but really he was like subtly trying to manipulate him into not taking the part.
Manipulation.
Which, so shrewd. I mean, John Landis, very sharp guy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So I thought that was an interesting story.
But then he went ahead and did Foul Play then.
He decided on Foul Play, maybe partly because of John Landis's persuasion, subtle persuasion.
Interesting.
And then we ended up getting Tim Matheson.
Yeah, Tim Matheson as Otter. We got Tom Hulce as Larry Kroger, a.k.a. Pinto. And Kent Dorfman.
Yes.
Flounder.
Mm-hmm.
We got, yeah, yeah.
Stephen First's film debut.
Oh, Stephen First was, which one?
He's Flounder.
Oh, Flounder. Oh, that's,
yeah.
Okay, I didn't write that thing.
Yeah, you might also remember Stephen First. He was on St. Elsewhere and Babylon 5.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Yeah, he had a good, healthy career.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a good number of, like, well-known actors in this movie, too. Mm-hmm. Kevin Bacon played Chip Diller.
His film debut.
Film debut. We had
Karen Allen. From Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It's Katie. Donald Sutherland's in this joint.
Yeah, Donald Sutherland helped make the movie, get the movie made.
Yeah, because I figure he at that point he probably was around for a while. Like,
yeah, he was like a big star in like the early 70s. And Universal was saying like, hey, it's great you have Belushi, but you need another big star in this thing for us to really get behind it. And John Landis knew Donald Sutherland. He was like a gopher on his movie Kelly's Heroes, which was like in the late 60s.
Okay.
It was like a World War II movie. And he actually babysat for young Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, well, baby Keef.
And so he was friendly with Donald Sutherland. So he asked Donald Sutherland, hey, would you be in this movie? And Sutherland was like, yeah, I'll be in this movie, but I'm not going to do it for just scale. He was getting like $25,000 a day.
Oh, wow.
So he was like the highest paid cast member.
He's not even into that much.
He worked 2 days on the movie, and so he got like a cool $50,000.
God damn.
For the movie. In 1978 money.
You could buy a country with that.
Again, I don't know how much that is. Let me.
Don't press the keyboard. Easy, easy. Okay.
And $10 billion again.
Criminy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could, that's buku bucks.
But Sutherland could have made out even better because he was offered either that as a flat fee or he could have gotten points in the movie, gotten percentage points. And if he'd taken the percentage points, he would have made millions of dollars.
Yeah, I think from what I hear, it seems like this was like a movie no one expected much from.
No.
like people, I mean, how did it even get made? Like, it was just like one of the things where, I mean, well, we know Doug Kenny like was the main writer on it.
Right. Okay. I mean, it really grew out of National Lampoon.
Right.
And it grew, Chris Miller, who was one of the three writers on the film,
right.
He had written stories that were about his time at Dartmouth. And
okay.
he'd been in a fraternity that was much like the real Delta House, basically.
Okay.
And he said that like Pinto, the character of Pinto was like him as a freshman, and the character of Boone was him like an older, wiser junior or senior.
All right.
So he'd written these stories for National Lampoon, and they were very popular. And Doug Kenny, who was the editor of National Lampoon, was a big fan of them.
Okay.
And Harold Ramis was somebody who had association with National Lampoon because he'd done the live show.
Yeah, the live show with the other people who would go on to be on SNL.
Right, so he'd worked with both of the Murray brothers and Gilda Radner and John Belushi.
Yeah, Chase. And,
yeah. And
wasn't Christopher Guest there too?
Yeah, Christopher Guest was a part of that, yeah. He had left the National Lampoon show by that point to, let's see, he says, he left to direct a PBS series in L.A. for my good friend Michael Shamberg. Which is not to say I would have been cast on SNL had I been there, but this sets the stage for the genesis of Animal House, the movie. This is from the intro that Harold Ramis wrote for a book that Chris Miller wrote.
What? What's
about
the
his fraternity days.
What's the name of that book?
It is called The Real Animal House, oh. a mostly lucid memoir by Chris Miller. And this, he kind of, I believe, expanded on his old National Lampoon stories.
Right.
And... and all that. So it's like half autobiography, half exaggerated retellings of his college days. So Ivan Reitman, who we now know as like the famous film producer and director at Ghostbusters and
of course.
All that, he was, I believe, a producer on the National Lampoon show, and he had gotten the rights to do like a movie if National Lampoon ever wanted to do like a collection of their sketches or something like that.
Right.
He approached... Harold Ramis to write it, and Ramis had he started a film treatment that he wrote to partly reminiscing about his college days
mm-hmm.
that was called Freshman Year, and he submitted it to Maddie Simmons, who is the publisher of the Lampoon, and Ivan Reitman, and he says it was clear nobody liked it enough to move forward. What we all recognized was that it lacked the spirit and hard comic edge of the Lampoon. So at that point, I suggested working with a Lampoon editor, Doug Kenny, a Harvard Lampoon alum and one of the founding partners of the National Lampoon. Doug was a Harvard graduate from Chagrin Falls, Ohio, and the Lampoon's leading comic authority on puberty and adolescence. He had edited and compiled Lampoon's highly successful high school yearbook parody, and had authored two classic Lampoon pieces, First Lay Comics and First High Comics, elements of which later found their way into the screenplay for Animal House. Given Doug's particular bent, he'd also written a novel called Teenage Commies from Outer Space. We set aside the notion of doing a college movie and instead laid out a high school film. Our story concerned Charles Manson in high school, a strangely seductive, demented loner living in the white bread world of typical Midwestern suburb, corrupting the local youth and forming a depraved cult of flying saucer-worshipping teenage zombies. We called it Laser Orgy Girls.
What the?
The marketing slogan for the popular American Graffiti had been, "Where were you in 62? Chris, ours was, "Where was he in 63? To Maddie and Ivan's credit, they actually liked it, but after a moment's reflection, suggested we go back to the idea of doing a college movie.
Yeah, I can't even wrap my mind around what you just said there.
Well, it sounds like it's really out there.
It does, doesn't it?
I can't imagine that movie becoming a mainstream success. Maybe a big cult hit.
Maybe a cult hit, but yeah, that's like, I don't see middle America taking their families out to see that.
So they brought in Doug Kenny.
Right.
And Doug Kenny was a big fan of Chris Miller and his college stories, so they said, let's bring in Chris Miller because he has all the college stuff to make this really
right.
work. And so the three of them got together. They all traded their college experiences, and they kind of mashed them up together.
Into this one big movie.
Right, right. And I think that's a large part of the beauty of the movie is it's grown out of their real experiences. So
right.
the stories you see in the movie, they have a basis in truth.
Yeah. I mean, as far as movies go, there's not much of a plot here. I mean, basically, all right, so the movie takes place in 1962 at a Faber College, with a fictional college, mm-hmm. and it starts off with our two, I guess, main characters.
Yeah.
Kind
of. I mean, the beginning of the movie is from their point of view, definitely.
Right. So it's Larry Kroger, Kent Dorfman, played by Hulse, and First.
Yes.
And then they're just trying to find places to pledge for college. And
yep.
So they first go to the Omega House, where we meet Doug Niedermeyer.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Greg... I forget.
Marmaland.
And we see that the Omega House is very kind of like hoity-toity, snooty, white bread.
Very waspy, very very Republican, for lack
yes.
of a better word.
Oh, that's a good word.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, they're being nice to them, but at the same time, they're being very condescending to them.
Are they being nice to them?
Well, that condescending nice, that fake niceness.
Outwardly nice.
Yeah, like,
at
oh, hey.
Most.
Yeah, hey, how's it going? Why don't you just stand over here with the other nerds and weirdos we don't want to talk to? All right,
yeah,
I'll catch you later. Yeah. And then they go away and make fun
and
of them.
Yeah, they shove them in a corner, and they're with a blind guy, and then there's an Indian guy.
Yeah.
And I think there were two Indian guys, weren't there?
Might have been, I don't remember.
Yeah.
But yeah,
so.
They kind of shove them in the corner with the other misfits who...
Yeah.
They get the vibe, oh, wait, we're not going to be welcome here.
Yeah, we don't want the nerdy guys. We don't want the people of the other races. And,
yeah, like we want to keep this nice and white.
So, I mean, right from the beginning, the movie lays down that demarcation between the good guys and the bad guys.
Yes, very much so. So then they go next door to the Delta House, and Kent says, oh, yeah, my brother went here. I'm Legacy.
Right.
And, of course, it's the exact opposite of the Omega House, because it's literally, like, just drunken people scream. They're met, when they first get there, they're met by Bluto, played by John Belushi, who's, like, urinating outside and saying, hey, is this the Delta House? And, of course, he turns around and ends up peeing on their feet.
Right.
Like,
and,
oh, yeah.
And you don't see that.
You don't
but
see
you just they just do it through the staging and the sound effects.
Right. You hear splashing.
Yeah. You don't even see wet pants.
Yeah.
But you see them, like, shaking their legs
exactly.
as they're going up the steps.
Right. So then you see that, like, they go into the Delta House, and it's, like, a total madhouse. Just,
mm-hmm.
like, there's literally, like, people just throwing beer bottles everywhere and just
yep.
people making out and screaming and hollering. It's at the whole.
But it looks like a really fun
it
party.
Looks like a fun time. It's total pandemonium.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we learn that the Dean Wormer, you know, looks down on them, and he wants them off campus because they're, like, the troublemaking house, and they're always into hijinks and shenanigans.
And when he's told that the fraternity is already on probation, he says, well, then they're on double secret probation, which is obviously something he just came up with in the moment.
Exactly.
And you have the great John Vernon playing Ooh. Dean Wormer.
Right.
Which, oh, so
he's
amazing.
Good. He plays it very straight, but it ends up being funny.
Yeah. It's the beauty of it is, I mean, he's got that great voice, that authoritarian voice.
Right.
That I don't know if it's like a baritone or
yeah, what.
Yeah,
what was that voice you were doing?
That was my mock John Vernon impression.
All right. I'm with you.
You know, he had that great booming voice. He was he was the voice of Boss Thorne on Batman the Animated Series.
Ooh,
if you're a fan
nice.
Of that show,
Ooh.
As I am.
Wow. Yes, so. His voice has gravitas.
Yes,
as some would say.
Yes.
So, they get into that fraternity. They enjoy it very, very much. And then after that, it's just kind of like a series of vignettes about
the slobs versus the snobs.
Very much so. Yeah. Like one of the things, like we're at the top is they have that one scene where I guess Kent and Larry, they go by mm-hmm. the name Pinto and Flounder. Those are they just give them these names. There's no
Those are their Delta Tai Cal names.
Yeah, there's no real rhyme or reason behind it. It's like, yeah, you look like a flounder. So his name is Flounder. And I believe there's the one where they're like kind of like in a military type of situation.
Mm-hmm. ROTC.
ROTC, yeah. And that's where we see Niedermeyer give that speech from. And like, oh, is that a pledge pin on your uniform?
Yes.
And that's when I was like, oh, that's from the Twisted Sister video.
Yeah, because like the lead singer of Twisted Sister, Dee Snider, he was like such a fan of that actor, Mark Metcalf, and him in Animal House that he put him in the video, and he's like quoting lines of dialogue in the song.
Yeah, like I totally didn't know. I mean, I of course, you know, growing up in the 80s, like I've seen the Twisted Sister video 100 times, and it was like, oh, that's from that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you saw the Twisted Sister video before you saw Animal House.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because, I mean, one you could just see on MTV anytime. And
yeah, yeah. And then at that point where he says, like, you're all worthless and weak. It's like, oh, that was in Twisted Sister, too. Hey.
Yeah, and at the end, like, Dee Snider's like, a pledge pin on your uniform. Now drop it. I mean, yeah.
I want to rock.
Yeah, and it's hilarious. And it was great that he gave Mark Metcalf a job in the video, too.
There you go.
So
Mark Metcalf got a check.
Yeah.
Hot dog. All right. But, yeah, and then after that, it's just, like, kind of a series of happenings. There's no real... I mean, like we said, like if it's like Snobs versus the Slobs.
It's a very episodic movie.
Yeah. I mean, there have that one point where like one of the people in the Delta House is Boone. He goes by the name Boone, and like, he has a girlfriend, Katie, and like they kind of...
Karen Allen.
Yeah, they're Karen Allen. And they kind of go through their relationship a little bit, but it doesn't really kind of fit in the movie.
I mean, we know from the beginning that they have a troubled relationship, and it's largely because Boone is so committed to the fraternity.
Right.
And he does things that are not in his best interest. And she's trying to pull him back to the side of sanity. And
right.
I mean, because like they're seniors and they're presumably going to graduate soon. So she's like, hey, we gotta start getting our lives together.
Let's be adults or something.
Maybe let's not be drunk every weekend and
yeah,
all this.
There was that too. But then we'll get to it. But then... I don't know. It was interesting. Like, I don't know how it fit. It fit kind of well into the movie. I didn't think it fit
well. I enjoyed their relationship because you can see why they have their problems, but you also see that there's enough of a chemistry and spark between them that you see why they're a couple in the first place.
Yeah, I could see
that. So I thought it worked well.
Yeah, I could see that. And we mentioned before, Donald Sutherland's in it. He plays Professor Jenkins.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he, you know, gets high with the students. I was like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, the 60s were a wild time.
And Donald Sutherland, he does not have anything approaching a period hairstyle. Because this movie takes place in 1962.
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland, he's got the mustache. He's got the curly 70s mop. Fro.
Yeah. It was like, oh, all right.
It's like, I mean, his character is like sort of a burgeoning hippie.
Yeah, like a stoner professor, and he kind of like talks to the students like, "Yeah, I don't want to be teaching this either," type of stuff.
Yeah, I'm teaching's just a way to pay the bills while I'm working on my novel.
Yes,
how long have you been working on your novel? 4.5 years.
I remember that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But that's pretty much it. I mean, this movie has like a bunch of crazy. One of the things that happens is they accidentally kill a horse in this film.
They do.
Which I was like, oh, wow, that is...
That
PETA would have a problem with that.
That is... maybe we should just give that a little
There's going to be a lot of problematic.
I'm surprised it took us that long to get to that. I mean, there are probably things we could have dinged before this, but...
We'll get there.
Yeah. Maybe I should just give the whole movie a blanket.
There's
some stuff we'll unpack later on.
There's some stuff we'll unpack. I mean, there's one in particular I'm like,
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd put that in there.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things in this movie would not be in a major motion picture today.
Yeah. I mean,
but
there is, like, it wasn't, it came very close. I mean, we'll talk about it.
But that was a National Lampoon. I mean, they were, before that term really existed, they were politically incorrect. They were outrageous. They were in horrible taste. But they were also funny as hell.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're funny, people forget a lot.
Yeah, that's true. All right, Dead Horse. So this happened because, as we said before, Niedermeyer was, you know, berating and belittling Flounder. And, of course, John Belushi and D-Day, played by Bruce McGill. They saw what he was doing, and so they're like, oh, you hate Niedermeyer, right, Flounder? He's like, yeah, yeah. You want to get back at him, right? Yeah, yeah. So, of course, they play this huge prank where they pull Niedermeyer's horse, because he loves this big white horse.
Take him out of the stables.
Take him out of the stables, bring him into the office.
The dean's office.
The dean's office.
Which, by the way, was the literal dean's office at the college where they shot the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, this is kind of an interesting story. They shot it at a college in Oregon. Okay. And the dean there, he had been at Berkeley when they were trying to get the graduate film there.
Oh, nice.
And the school turned him down because they didn't like the script. And then The Graduate is this big hit movie. So this guy, he says, like, well, I guess I just don't know how to read Hollywood scripts. I can't tell what's going to be a good movie or not.
Okay.
So, and Animal House, because the script was so outrageous, they were having a lot of trouble finding a college to shoot at.
Understood.
And this guy was like, well, I guess I don't know what makes a good movie or not. So, yeah, you can shoot here in Oregon.
Okay.
And he gave them permission and let them shoot in his office. They brought a horse into his office.
An actual horse into your...
Apparently.
Wow.
And, yeah, and then they have Flounder, like, shoot a gun. They try to tell Flounder... Oh, you have to shoot the horse. And they give him a gun filled with blanks.
They give the freshman a gun and saying, murder this horse
right.
in this guy's office. But, of course, they know it's, oh, the guns are just full of blanks.
So it's just a prank. And then Flounder, because he doesn't want to shoot a horse in cold blood, he shoots the gun in the air. And then apparently the horse has a heart attack and dies in the office.
And they're like, oh, my God, what did you do? And, of course, they just run.
And by the way, the editing is so brilliant because they have a shot of the horse, like, I don't know what the horse was doing, but they freeze the frame as the horse has like this really unnatural head position, and it just looks so freaked out.
Yeah, and like then the horse died, and then they're like, oh my God, and then they just of course run away screaming.
Right, and then there's another scene in the dean's office shortly after where you see just horse legs sticking straight up in the air, and a janitorial guy measuring to try and see how he can get this dead horse out of the door.
Yeah, and then doesn't somebody like pull out a chainsaw?
At the end of the scene, you hear a chainsaw being like, started up.
Like, there's got to be a better way than that. I'm no animal doctor.
We'll do a little animal cruelty.
Sorry.
I don't remember if I dinged that before or not. Yeah, but
sorry, PETA.
They didn't literally kill a horse, I'm assuming. I didn't check the credits to see if they had that disclaimer. I don't even know if they had that disclaimer in 1978.
Were animals harmed in the making of this film, John?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know, and I was six at the time, so I couldn't really do anything about it if they did.
Oh, boy.
That horse would be dead of natural causes now anyway. So.
That horse lived a good life.
Yeah.
He was fine.
Yeah.
He's in a better place.
Well, apparently the horse was like the second highest paid cast member. Yeah.
Really?
The horse and John Belushi both got $40,000 for the movie.
Wow.
So the horse, I'm assuming, was well taken care of.
That horse is part of the 1%. So everybody who's like upset
that's right.
about the horse, like that horse was living on the high horse.
Yeah, we have it on good authority. That horse was just an utter bastard.
He would have voted for Trump.
Yeah.
So he's fine. So maybe that'll soften it
right,
a little bit.
Right.
But yeah, and then like there's just a bunch of vignettes. It's like a lot of Greg and his girlfriend Babs being, you know, like, oh, those deltas. But then again, we find out like early Babs is having an affair with Otter.
Well, she has hooked up with Eric Stratton Otter at some point in the past.
Yeah. Oh, and, were they still hooking, or is it just?
I don't think it was still an ongoing thing. That was not the impression I got.
All right. Yeah, I didn't know if they were still hooking up, or it just happened once, or.
I got the impression that it just happened once, and I mean Eric, because he's like a player.
Right.
He's like, hey, well, you know, we should hook up again, and she's like, no, that's fine. It wasn't that great.
Right. Of course. And then we find out that in the cafeteria, and of course that's the iconic food fight scene. Of course, also right. where. Bluto like is eating all this food, like grossing out everybody.
He's going down the lunch line, picking, just filling up his tray. He's got mound of stuff on his tray.
Don't know much about history.
Yeah, he sits down at the table with Otter, and then Otter's talking with some of the Omega people. And Belushi does that famous, see if you can guess what I am now.
And he fills up his mouth like mashed potatoes,
and there's. Hits both of his cheeks and then spatters the mashed potatoes all over him. And he says, I'm a zit. Get it?
Yeah. Oof. that was something.
And it starts the food fight. And it's a famous thing, but it's really just a quick thing in the movie. It's like literally like a 3-second shot.
It really is. It almost seemed like an afterthought that this included that. But it's one of the most iconic scenes.
But they shot it for real.
Yeah, absolutely.
They had an actual food fight.
That boy,
and John Landis was like, throw people.
Don't throw people.
Don't throw people. That would be wrong.
Yeah,
we've killed a horse. We're not going to throw people.
They're union.
We got to save that for the parade sequence at the end.
Ooh, we'll get to that.
But
that boy is a P.I.G. pig. And another iconic scene is the one where Bluto peeps in on some women getting undressed with a ladder.
As you do.
As one does in college.
Yes.
You know, and he's like.
Because it was 1978/1962, and that was still innocent hijinks.
Yeah,
that was totally okay.
That was cool back then.
That was not voyeurism. Well, I guess it was voyeurism, but it wasn't bad voyeurism then. It was fine, and we'll just do a little.
Boys will be boys.
And it's interesting how the movie just gets steadily more absurd as it goes.
It does, yeah.
Because, like, by the end, we're dealing with, like, total cartoon logic.
Yeah, very much so.
Like, I mean, in the scene where Bluto is peeping in at the sorority girls.
Right.
And it's not like how most movies would do it, where he's just, like, peeking up over the edge of the windowsill.
You can see him.
He is fully in the window frame. It's like there is no effing way people would not see him if they are looking at all in the direction of the window.
There was one point where, like, I guess it was Babs. She was, like, you know, taking off her shirt, taking off her bra, looking out at the window.
That was actually Mandy, but it's easy to mix them up.
Yeah, I get it. But, like... She's looking right at him. I'm like, how do you not see? He's right there.
It's not that dark
out.
Yeah.
Then again, there is that kind of cool scene where Bluto kind of turns and looks right into the camera.
I love that. I love that.
He breaks the fourth wall that one time.
That is a great moment. And it's usually kind of lame when movies break the fourth wall like that. But that is a moment of breaking the fourth wall that really, really works.
Yeah, he just like looks at the camera and is like,
Belushi just gives you this conspiratorial look where it's just like, hey, we're all about to see her boobs, huh? You know? And it's...
And say no more, say no more.
And, you know, honestly, that's probably what's going through most audience members' minds at that point. And just
Dudes like boobs.
And it's just Belushi like kind of like... You're in on the joke with Belushi, and it's a great moment.
Yeah, and I guess it took me long to realize, I mean, when I got older, that scene where, like, he falls off the ladder.
Yeah.
When I first saw it, I guess, because I did see this movie, like, years and years ago. Like,
it's kind of subtle.
Yeah, kind of subtle, but then as I got older, I was like, oh, his boner pushed him off the ladder, and that's how he fell.
Yeah.
It's a boner joke.
I think there was like some sort of Animal House picture book that I think like again took bits of the National Lampoon stories.
There's a picture book with a boner?
It doesn't show an actual picture, but in the
is
text,
it a pop-up book
in the text, it makes it clear that it is Bluto's boner that pushes him away from the wall and makes the ladder fall down.
It must be one hell of a boner if it like pushes. Is it strong enough to push you off a wall?
Well, he was a young guy.
I see.
So, you know, he had a lot.
Virile.
He had stamina. So.
That's right.
Just strong like bull.
Oh, he don't need no Viagra.
Nope.
But then what else happened? Oh, yeah. Well, I guess to push on the plot, I guess.
Uh-huh.
There's a scene where they kind of steal test answers, the Delta House, so they can pass the next test. But I think
But the Omegas, they trick them. They switch the testing answers out on the mimeograph, the carbon that they steal from the garbage.
I remember that carbon. It used to be a thing.
Yeah, it was like a pre-photocopy age.
Right. So. Exactly. So then, like, they all get the test wrong.
Yeah.
So they're, of course, that's when the dean is like comes down and. He's like, oh, I see you all got the wrong answers.
Right.
One more slip up and you're out of here. Because he really wants to get the Delta House out. So.
And when faced with this, the Deltas decide to do the only thing they can do, which is, of course, a toga party.
Of course. What else are you going to do?
A toga party.
And they're like, wait, no, shouldn't we like try to stay on campus? Because like, it looks like we're really on the shit list.
Yeah.
And they're like, look, whatever we do, they're going to kick us out anyway, so let's just have a party.
Yeah, and they have a toga party, and when they're preparing for the toga party, they go to like the local store to get supplies and stuff.
Steal supplies.
And yeah, that's true. That's true.
They shoplift like blatantly.
Blatantly. They tuck Pinto's sweater into his pants and they just load him up with like steaks and all the meat products.
All the fixins.
And Otter is in the produce section, and he spies an attractive older lady there.
Cougar.
And yes, and he discovers after talking to her for a few minutes, it's Dean Wormer's wife.
Oh,
and he invites her over to the party that evening.
Oh, plot thickens.
Because, I mean, Otter has.
His penis just does the thinking for him.
Yeah, yeah. He's I mean, it is a bold move, I will say
it
that.
It is. That's a ballsy move.
A ballsy move.
You don't know how
in every sense of the term.
Oh, ho! Wordplay. But yeah, because you don't know how that's going to go down.
No.
She could be like, talk to her husband. It's like, you know what this guy tried to...
But Dean Wormer's wife, into it.
Yeah, she's...
Into it. Shows up at the party.
Yeah, she's all boozed up. She like crashes in front of the place.
She comes from like an alumni dinner or something, and she's half in the bag.
Right, and El Pinto, like as they leave the supermarket, the checkout girl lets him go by.
Yeah.
She's kind of cute, so Pinto's like, oh, do you want to come to this?
He invites checkout girl to the party.
And of course, she's like, oh, I got to talk to my dad before I can go out.
Yeah.
Like, and right then, I was like, why does she have to talk to her parents? I wonder if this is going to come into play later on in the movie.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think there'll be any sort of consequences for those actions.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
I'm probably just overthinking it.
So at the party we got Pinto. He's there with the checkout girl.
Right.
We got Dean Wormer's wife.
She's there. We got Otis Day in the Nights.
Kent Dorfman brings his girlfriend.
Yeah, I didn't even know he had a girlfriend until this point.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, and oh,
and Otter's hitting on her too.
Yeah, because Otter, he just don't care. Don't bring your girl around him. True player for real, Lex Puff Daddy.
Yeah,
We got Bluto smashing people's acoustic guitars against walls.
Yes, that's a little cameo from Stephen Bishop, who did the theme song for the movie.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and apparently that famous scene where Belushi is smashing the guitar against the wall, it was supposed to smash on the first hit.
Oh.
Because they weakened the guitar so it could smash apart easily.
Right.
But it didn't. And so Belushi just kept going and just keeps... And until it's, like, all splintered.
That's actually kind of funny.
Yeah, it is. And so, like, people are... You're seeing people's genuine horrified reactions.
That's all genuine.
Love that.
I love it. Yeah, absolutely. And, Otis Day and the Nights.
Yeah.
Singing the now iconic... You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout.
The actor playing the lead singer of Otis Day. He's playing Otis Day,
right?
Lead singer of Otis Day and the Nights.
Of course.
That was an actor by the name of Dwayne Jesse.
Oh.
And his part in this movie became so famous, he has legally changed his name to Otis Day.
Really?
And he tours colleges, I believe, to this day. As Otis Day, and plays like numbers from Animal House, and I think other blues and
like early
rock
50s.
Songs. Yeah, 50s, 60s songs.
That's pretty awesome. Wait, so he was originally just an actor.
Yes,
and he became...
not even his voice that you hear in the movie.
What?
It's somebody. He is lip syncing to somebody else's voice.
What?
So yeah.
So he had to learn how to. So like this movie became so big, he was like, you know, screw it. I'm a singer now.
I am Otis Day now. He just became Otis Day. This is like his secret origin story.
That is bonkers. And he had to learn how to sing.
I guess. Yeah.
That is
nuts, right?
That is pretty bonkers.
That's nuts.
Nuts. So it's just. So yeah, this toga party is just all types of insane. I believe Boone gets Dean Wormer's wife up to his
Otter.
What did I say?
You said Boone.
Oh, all right.
I
kind of got them confused a little
bit. Well, they're together a lot.
Yeah, like Boone and Otter and Hoover is like
Hoover. Hoover is the president. Right. Otter is the hound.
Right,
and Boone is the guy with Katie as the girlfriend.
Right. What is Boone's? I guess he's just there. Does he have like a title? Because I know Otter is a Rush chairman.
Yeah.
But I don't think they ever said what Boone was.
No, I don't know if Boone has a title in the Deltas. That's a good question that I'm not prepared to answer.
Okay. Oh.
So
they're known homosexuals.
Yeah.
Which is a line from the movie.
Yeah.
Watch the movie, you'll get that hilarious joke.
Yeah, no.
All right, but so it looks like Otter took up Dean Wormer's wife up to his grotto at one point.
Which, I mean, this is where the movie puts every other college comedy to shame, because, like, there have been a million comedies with, like, rebellious fraternities and stuff, and, like, and they all have, like, their own stunts and the outrageous things they do.
Right.
No, Animal House, we nailed the dean's wife.
Yes.
that is going way beyond what any other college comedy does.
Indeed. I mean American Pie came close when Stifler banged with his face his mom. Not Stifler.
Stifler's mom.
Stifler's mom got banged out by Finch.
Banged out.
What?
Okay.
What?
No, I just was not expecting that phrasing.
It's a funny phrase, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
And and of course there's another scene where Pinto goes upstairs with this lovely young lady, and she passes out, and it comes very close to being a date rape scene, but he doesn't do it.
She passes out because she gets very drunk very, very quickly.
Right.
Because she gets to the party late and she's like, oh, I have to drink more to make up for lost time.
Right.
And then they're up in Hoover's room and things are getting hot and heavy. And just as she's like unclasping her bra, she passes out.
Right.
Leaving Pinto's hands with a handful of tissues that were stuffed in her bra.
Right.
And then so this young lady is passed out topless on the floor, and he gets a literal angel and devil on his shoulder, counseling him on what he should do in this situation.
It gets it gets very un-PC.
This is something that you could these are jokes that you could make in the late 70s that I do not think you could make today.
I don't want to make these today, but yeah.
I think it's still a funny scene.
It's.
I will go there. I will say that.
All right, but he doesn't do it. He's a gentleman. He drops her off at her house in a shopping cart,
and which is where we find out that she is the daughter of the mayor.
Yeah.
of the town.
Right. There's another scene before this where the mayor was talking to Dean Wormer about the homecoming parade.
Yeah.
About how I think they were trying to like sort of strike a deal about their college being represented.
Using the streets of the town Faber? I know it's Faber College.
Yeah, it's Faber. Okay. The town it's a fictional town called Faber. Mm-hmm. And how the mayor has concerns because he's heard about Delta House and how
He doesn't want Delta making any trouble.
Exactly.
At the homecoming parade. This is what is called foreshadowing.
Yes. And of course, after now we found out that his daughter had been... something happened at the Delta House, and she comes home drunk in a shopping cart.
Yeah,
and
in a toga.
In a toga, and of course, that gets back to the dean, and now the dean has a disciplinary probation hearing.
And I love that they have the headline about the disciplinary probation hearing, and then the camera pans down to a sub heading, and it just says Dean Wormer's wife vacationing in Sarasota Springs, Florida.
Mm.
And apparently, I just read this. This is an in-joke that Chris Miller put in to his old Dartmouth classmates because apparently there was a house of ill repute that several Dartmouth fraternity lads visited in Sarasota Springs. So that was so she's not just there to dry out, apparently.
It's saucy.
Just, yeah. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, because I didn't get that line. I was like, she was just like hiding?
Well, I think it's just they're getting her out of the...
She could have got slammed up by what? She did.
Yeah, I know. When you throw in like, yeah, she got slammed out. I mean, it just hits me unexpectedly. And
hey, we're not here to shame anybody.
Hey, yeah, you go.
Yeah,
Mrs. Dean Wormer.
Yeah, you want to get porked? You get porked.
Yeah, yeah. You get that young college Tim Matheson ass.
Yas queen.
Yeah. Because she is a liberated woman, and she can make her own decisions, damn it.
Darn tootin'.
That's right.
She wants that dong, she can get it.
That's right.
So then the disciplinary probation hearing happened, and it's basically like the Delta House wants to have their say, but it's very skewed already. Like The fix is in. The dean just wants the Omegas to have their say, but they're not letting the Delta have their say.
But Otter, he gets up and he gives a big speech. It's just all BS.
Right.
I love the preamble to the speech. He's like, well, let me talk. I'm pre-law. And they're like, I thought you were pre-med. What's the difference?
And then, yeah, Otter has like this plaid suit jacket.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's a look.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, he literally starts out and he's like, the point is not whether we broke a few rules or took advantage of some of our female guests. We did. And then he winks at Dean Wormer, the man whose wife he violated like a night or two before.
Yeah, Otter is a real... He's something else.
He is a charismatic asshole.
Yeah, that's the term.
Yeah. I mean...
Chevy Chase definitely could have played him.
You would have liked him less.
Because
Tim Matheson, very likable performer. I've liked him in everything I've seen him in, and you can see him being very charming and very... And he's more of a classically handsome guy. I think... It's better that really well cast movie. I mean, everybody is just dead solid perfect for their roles.
All right, cool.
So,
all right,
that's what I say.
Yeah, all right. So, so then they just kind of walk out knowing that they're not gonna have their say, and they go out in protest you know, they said they're doing it for America. They all start humming, God Bless America or something.
I don't know. The soundtrack picks it up.
Yeah, and of course, Dean Worm is like, you're finished, you're through, you're blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I guess at this point, they like throw them out. Or
yeah, Dean, he threatens to have their charter pulled.
Right.
And then we see, they are dismantling the house later on. So he was successfully able to get their national charter pulled.
Yeah, so they're taking out all the stuff out of their house, even the stuff they didn't steal.
Right, right. And they're removing the flags and the letters, the Greek letters in the front.
Right, so right. And like at one point somebody's carrying like a case of beer and he accidentally trips and breaks them and Bluto's like, oh no!
Yeah.
Like he they're all very disheartened. I think at one point Otter tosses Bluto like a full bottle of
Jack Daniels.
Jack Daniels, and he downs it like in one gulp.
Yeah.
Like, and you can see like Belushi's actually doing that.
It's shot in one take, and it was actually iced tea that they were doing.
I had a feeling, yeah.
I read a little about the shooting of the movie. Belushi was clean at this time, and he was like working hard to stay clean.
Oh, yeah.
So he was not really partaking of the partying.
Okay.
That was happening.
Okay,
so.
Far out. So. But yeah, but the fact that he could just like down that like so quickly.
That is impressive. Even with iced tea, it is impressive that you downed like 3/4 of a bottle of Jack Daniels in one gulp.
Yeah, I was like, wow, that is impressive, sir.
Yeah.
So so everybody's kind of, you know, disheartened, trying to figure out what to do. And I think at this point, Boone and Otter are like, well, what we should do is...
Road trip.
Yeah, exactly. So they just like take the car, they take Flounder's brother's car.
Right.
And Flounders, of course, no, take my brother's car. He wants it back by Sunday.
Right.
And they just get like a case of beer and they just drive off to meet up with some babes.
Yeah, they go to a nearby women's college and Otter has a clipping from that school's paper. And he's like, well, what was this girl's name again? And they were like, oh, Fawn Leibowitz. And we don't really know what this is about.
Right.
And he pulls up and he goes into the lobby and he says, oh, I'd like to see Fawn. I'm her fiance.
Right.
And then her roommate comes down to break something to him. We don't know what. And we find out over the course of the scene that Fawn Leibowitz was a sophomore, I believe, who got killed in a kiln explosion.
Oh, Lord.
In the ceramics lab.
Oh, rest in peace. Yeah.
And this is his scheme to pick up girls.
Yeah, he pretends to be Fawn's fiance, and of course, he didn't know that, you know, Fawn dies. And so
he's distraught over this. And he's like, I just don't think I should be alone tonight. Could you come out with me?
Yeah.
And bring dates for 3 of my friends?
Like, oh my God.
And apparently one of Chris Miller's real fraternity brothers actually tried this. I don't remember if it succeeded or not, but I believe this was at least tried at some point.
Yeah, that's so. Yeah, so through that, he gets dates for himself and Boone and Pinto and Flounder.
Yeah.
And then they go try to find a place to hang out. They find this club that Otis Day is also playing at, Otis Day and the Knights. They go in there. It's an all-black club.
And
they're the only white people in there.
Yeah. Wait till Otis sees us. He'll be so excited to see us.
And of course, Otis sees them. He has no idea who they are. He's like, what the fuck? Who are you?
The looks that I love that when they walk into the club, all noise in the club stops dead. The band stops playing on a dime.
I'm pretty sure I heard a record scratch.
All conversation stops, and then
gentrification.
And then Otter just leans in and goes, "We are going to die."
Yeah. So of course they try to play it off. They're like, "Oh no, this is fine, and let's hang out here." And of course, it gets very awkward because
everyone is very nervous because
he's very nervous because
racial relations were not in a great place in 1962.
You don't say.
Yeah,
really.
This is my understanding.
It wasn't Shiny Happy People all the live long day.
It was not
60s?
Because the song Shiny Happy People would not come out for another 30 years. So
that's the one that brought us all together. Remember that?
Exactly.
After that, racism was a thing of the past.
Exactly. It was all solved by REM in 1992.
That's right. We did it.
That's historical fact.
Everything's a beautiful rainbow now, guys.
And I just love, like, at one point Boone just like calls out to Otis. He's like, "Hey, Otis, my man." And then Otis just gives him a look like, what the are you doing? Who are you? What is he has no memory of the guy from the fraternity party he played probably just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And this scene, it's so wrong, but it's so funny.
And then, of course, as the scene goes on, everybody's very uncomfortable. But then, a black person just kind of sits with them and not say anything. And one end, and then just, another just black person comes, and they kind of circle them, and they're what's going on, guys?
And then one huge, they come over to the table, and they're like, do you mind if we dance with your dates? I'm not going to do the voice that the guy does, but
that's
imagine the most exaggerated black man voice.
Like, say, man.
And they're like, oh, why, no, we don't mind. And then we just see some hands come, take their table, rip it up off of the floor.
Because, we have that strength.
Oh, God. And I just remembered, there's another, when Otis and the band is playing, we hear Pinto. He asks his date, "Oh, what is your major?" And she says, "Primitive cultures." And then it immediately cuts to Otis Day.
I didn't want to say anything, but I was like, "What the fuck is this?"
I mean, this scene goes for it.
Yeah,
it goes. And on the IMDb trivia page, the first item is: according to John Landis, Universal Pictures president Ned Tannen objected so strongly to the Dexter Lake Club scene that he interrupted a screening of the film and he ordered the scene to be removed immediately, claiming it would cause race riots in the theaters. He was saying that black audiences would pull their chairs up out of the
can't pull up chairs out of the brown people.
Did Ned Tannen think that all black people have superhuman strength?
Didn't you read the come on? You read Luke Cage? They can do these things. They're bulletproof, they can pass through walls. My God, man. Did you read Black Lightning? My God, there's no end to what they can do. They can control the weather, like Storm and X-Men. They can do anything. My God.
So, but the way this ended up, they kept it in the film, was John Landis screened the film for Richard Pryor, who then wrote a note to Tannen, which read, "Ned, Animal House is fucking funny, and white people are crazy. Richard." So they kept it in the film.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
and as far as I know, there were no race riots because of this.
I would have heard about that. I don't think they were brought
because
up.
I mean, as a black person, did you find this scene funny?
It was riding the line a little bit. I was like when they said, "Oh, primitive."
By the way, have we given this?
There you go.
There's a little blanket scene for that.
Yeah, because they said like, "Oh, primitive."
Yeah, primitive cultures.
And then they cut to Otis Day, and now part of me was like, "Did they just do?" Was that intentional?
That is 100% intentional, Darren.
I don't know if I was like they were messing with me.
No,
like, was that?
No,
was that?
And then you are not reading a thing into that scene. That is not subtext. That is text.
All right.
That is text right there.
Yeah. So I was like, I don't know. And then of course, let's go back. The guy saying, "Do you mind if we dance with your dates?" And they're like, "No, not at all." And then of course they get so freaked out by the guy ripping off the table. The guys immediately just leave and abandon the women there.
Yes, and we didn't mention before, Otter is still playing the grief card. So he pretends to be overcome with grief. He goes out to the car. He sits in the back seat. And then his date, who I'm afraid I've forgotten her name, but she goes out to comfort him. And that turns into
A
makeout session. They're getting hot and heavy in the car. And then we see when the other Deltas come storming out, she... Right. screams and dives out of the car.
Right, she gets out of the car, and then the guys just peel out.
Yeah.
The Negroes took our dates.
By the way, that's there's kind of an obvious continuity issue there.
What's that?
I don't know if you... But once you notice it, you can't not notice it.
Oh, what is
it? So the woman in the back seat with Otter, she is topless, as you are in movies of the late 70s.
Of course. Of course.
And she dives out of the car. But when there's a shot of her diving through the window into the back seat of another car, she has her bra back on.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Which, totally understandable. If I was a young actress and I was having to do that stunt, I would damn well want a bra on.
Of course.
You want to protect the goods.
I want a bra on now.
Exactly. I mean, it's cover these sometimes tetons. I feel like I need a little support.
Yeah. Covered up these tetons.
Yeah. but it's just there's no human way you could get a bra on that quickly, of course. But
Yeah, I mean,
but I find that mildly amusing.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was great. So yeah, so then the guys peel off without the dates, without the women, mm-hmm. and then the end up, women end up like walking back.
Yeah.
To their house,
and there's like, what I don't understand is what Fawn would have seen in a boy like that. Because they still believe the cover story.
Yeah.
And they don't know these guys' real names.
Yeah, they're...
And it's...
It's before the internet. You can't track them down.
It's so wrong, but it is so, so funny.
It's a lot of wrong.
I mean...
Then what else do we have? Katie, we find out, had a affair with their professor.
Yeah, the next morning, Boone's checking up on his girlfriend, Katie.
Yeah.
And,
Then we see that, you know, she has...
We see a little Donald Sutherland butt.
Donald butt. Yeah.
Apparently, he did that as like something for the gag reel.
Okay,
and they kept it in the movie, and I think it was also because like they had Karen Allen do a butt shot as she's like coming out of the bedroom.
And
Donald Sutherland showed his butt as I think a gag, and she's like, well, if Donald Sutherland can show his butt, I guess I can show mine.
Yeah.
So because solidarity,
butts for everybody.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
And I don't know what else happened. I guess at this point. Greg found out that Otto was sleeping with his girl.
Yeah, or has slept with her at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
In the past.
And that's like another thing that happened throughout the movie where like it's him and his girl, they're at like lookout point.
Yeah.
And she's like constantly like whacking him off, but he's like so upset over
Yeah, and this is all like happening out of camera
shot.
It's happening behind the dash of the car.
We don't see an actual HJ.
But her hands come up and she's taking off like a rubber glove.
Like a surgical glove. Like, she just came out of surgery.
Which, I mean, just shows how wonderfully repressed and screwed up these characters are.
Yeah, it does. So
Greg is apparently 100% impotent.
Yes.
Because he's not having an erection during all this simulation.
Weenie no work.
No.
Yeah, because at one point he's like, oh, it's supposed to be this soft.
And again, as we established, pre-Viagra age.
That's so right. You got no pill for that.
Greg is SOL.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Sure, he is. His dong no worky.
No.
So at this point, he finds out that Otter's been sleeping with his girl. So he tricks Otter to he makes Otter think that he's meeting up with not Babs, the other one.
Mandy.
Mandy.
Yeah.
At a motel. Mm-hmm. Of course, Otter gets there, and it's Greg and all his goons.
They're the cronies, the Omega cronies. Yeah. They're beating him up.
They beat the tar out of him.
That's right.
Yeah. And actually, at this point, Dean Wormer puts down a hammer and says that the guys are out.
Yeah, because their midterm grades have come back, and they are so awful.
Yes.
Like, Pinto has, I think, like 2 C's, 2 D's, and an F.
And he's
the highest.
He's the best.
He's got a 1.2 GPA, and they say, you're the highest GPA in the Deltas. And one of them, in this scene in Dean Wormer's office, one of them actually was like, hey, nice going.
Nice. Well done, all right.
I think it was Bluto, who was like giving him a thumbs up or something like that.
I mean, and there was one good line Wormer had where he talks about Flounder's grades and how they're really bad, and then he says, fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son. Which is it's fair.
That's a good guide for life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, he gets to Bluto, Mr. Oh, wait. And he gets to D-Day. D doesn't have any records there.
No, he has no grade point average. All courses incomplete.
Yeah.
Because D-Day's off doing his D-Day things.
Yeah, D-Day's a mystery. No one knows what he does.
Yeah.
And of course, Mr. Blutarski, 0.0.
Which is perversely impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to work to get a 0.0.
It's double
GPA.
Digits. Yeah. You got to work to get nothing.
That's no.
Right.
So he expels the lot of the Deltas, all of them, out of school. And he's also saying, and I've informed your draft boards that you are all now available for military service. Which, 1962, not a good time for that.
Something was happening.
A little thing called Vietnam starting to heat up.
Something happening here.
It's
what it is. Ain't a...
Yeah. So
they go back to the house, dejected.
Mm-hmm. Otter comes back. He's all beaten up and bloody.
Yeah, I didn't. That was at one point, too, where like Otter, where they said, Otter, what happened to you? Like, Greg and his goons beat me up. And I was like, why'd they beat you up? It's like, I don't know. I guess we're just animals like that. I was like, weren't you sleeping with his girl?
Well, no, I mean, they don't say, hey, we're beating you up because you slept with
Mandy.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, you got to infer that, the guy whose girl I slept with is beating me up. Maybe the two are connected. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I feel like his whatever he had that went on with Mandy happened far enough in the past that he's maybe not making that immediate connection.
I guess so.
But, I mean, let's face it. The Omegas have many, many reasons to hate the Deltas and vice versa.
Yes, of course. It's
and vice versa. A
lot of hate. Exactly. So, so of course, they're all dejected. They don't know what they're going to do. And that's when Bluto makes his big speech. You know, they say, oh, it's over. Of course, Bluto
it's not
says,
over till we say it's over. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, it's like, it's, no, it's not over.
The Germans? No, forget it. He's rolling.
Yeah. And the going gets tough.
Yeah. And
the
and
tough gets going.
And this scene is wonderful because, I mean, we it starts out, Bluto says, like, 7 years of college down the drain. And then, like, a minute later, he's apparently legitimately thinks that the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor. So he has not learned a thing at Faber.
Nuh-uh.
A school where their motto is literally knowledge is good. Which
I didn't even notice that.
Oh yeah, the statue at the beginning, they have a statue of Emil Faber, the founder. And then the
Emil Faber?
Emil. E M I L.
Oh, Emil, okay.
Yeah. And it pans down and it just has the in quotes it says, knowledge is good. Which is just it's so wonderfully stupid and trite. I love it.
I did not notice that.
And that lost my train. And also, like, I love in Bluto's speech where he's like, when the going gets tough. And there's this awkward pause, and the soundtrack just does a cue.
It keeps
like,
going.
Bum, bum. And it's the score, by the way, Elmer Bernstein, who's just brilliant, and it makes the movie all the funnier.
Okay.
So shout out to him.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, at this point, they figure they need to do, as Otter says, a futile and stupid gesture.
Oh, that's a catchy phrase.
Yeah.
That'd make a good title.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, of course, now they plan to make this big spectacle at the homecoming parade.
Right.
And which is like the big ending.
Yeah, and they make their own float for the homecoming parade.
Right.
And they're using the body of the wrecked car from Flounder's brother.
Right. Oh, yeah, they wrecked Flounder's brother's car. I don't know if I mentioned that.
They crashed into lots of cars in the parking lot, and they crashed it as they were leaving frantically because they were the Negroes took their dates.
Of course, as you do. But at this point, at this point, like Otter said, oh yeah, just tell your brother like it got smashed, and like the insurance company will take care of it. That'll be great.
Yeah.
And of course, Flounder's like, oh okay.
Yeah.
And so like then D-Day takes like a blowtorch to the car and they just make it this whole kind of like groovy Ghoulies monster mobile.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it looks kind of like the 1966 Batmobile.
That's it. The
because
Batmobile.
It's black with like the red trim. Mm. And I mean, even though in the universe of the movie, it's taking place 4 years before Batman premiered, I still love that little.
Maybe Batman was inspired
by
Animal.
By the Deathmobile. Maybe. In the Animal House universe.
Mm.
The producers of Batman, they saw the press coverage.
The AHU, the Animal House universe?
That's right. Nice. That's right. The National Lampoon Animal House universe.
The NLU. Oh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Oh, so we also learn, so Pinto goes back to the girl's house who he left in a shopping cart.
Yeah.
They hook up, and then we find out that girl's 13 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Woo!
First off, I remembered it as 14. So when she said I'm actually 13, I was even more horrified.
Yeah.
But apparently, I think they wanted to say she was like 16 or 17.
Like that might be a little better.
And they shot it with her being 13 as like the more outrageous option, so that they could get what they really wanted.
Yeah.
In there, past the censors.
Okay.
But apparently, her being 13 just passed.
Oh,
it's
they were fine with that. That bell's getting a workout today. Wow.
So,
but yeah, I was like, oh,
yeah. So, I mean, Pinto is in college, so he's at least 17, if not 18.
Yeah. So
she is.
The
actress, by the way, was like 18 or 19 when she shot the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So,
all right. But also, like Pinto is a virgin too.
Yeah,
but then they go and they hook up at a football field.
Yeah, on like the 50-yard line.
Yeah, so right, 50-yard. Oh, interesting.
I'm assuming it was a 50-yard line. I wasn't looking at the.
You weren't you weren't noticing the numbers.
No.
All right, but yeah, so like he hooked up with a 13-year-old, which the '60s were a different time, man. you know, just people underage boning to and fro. I
don't know what to say.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, what can you say? I mean,
I can't.
It is a very funny, shocking moment.
It is
because you know Tom Hulce is like he's getting his undershirt off and he stops like mid.
Yeah, he's like he's about to take his shirt off and he says, oh yeah, by the way, I'm 13. But then he stops. But then they cut right to the parade. They don't show what he did. You just it's up to your own imagination.
And we see Pinto rush in with the girlfriend. I'm forgetting the character's name. Mm-hmm. And she runs up to her dad, the mayor, and she's like, oh, this is Larry, the boy who violated me last month.
Oh,
we have to get married.
So the parade. Let's quick get
the parade.
So basically, they build a float.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, no, they have the car and they build a float.
Yeah,
this huge like cake float that says "Eat Me" on the side.
Right. Sure.
And yes, they pretty much crash the parade.
Right. And they make a shambles of it. They crash into the other floats. They sabotage everything all the Omegas are doing. The ROTC is there.
One of the Deltas, played by Doug Kenny, plays Stork.
Yes, Stork. I was trying to remember the character's name.
Right. Yeah. Who has the line of, what are we supposed to do, you moron?
Yeah. Brilliant performance. I mean, he just has that one line, but he has a fully fleshed out character.
Right. So, like, Stork, like, kind of leads the marching band in the parade. He managed to lead the marching band down an alley and kind of leave them there.
And they're all stuck. The climax of this movie, we are in a full cartoon logic world.
Very much so.
Because he leads the band into the alley and nobody like stops and says, hey, we're in a dead end.
Yeah.
No, they all just like run into each other and become stuck and stuffed in the alley.
Yeah, they just all, it's like a toy robot in the corner.
Yeah.
They just can't get out. Just
it's like if like your Roomba gets stuck in a, in a corner.
Yeah, that's even better. Yes. Yeah. Your Roomba in a corner.
Right.
So, they crash the parade. They cause all types of pandemonium and the whole melee.
There's a float that's like promoting racial unity. It's got a white hand and a black hand clasping hands, and then they crash into that float, and the two hands separate. And
it was
the subtext of that gag is outrageous and it's hilarious. And there was a float with women dressed up as Playboy bunnies.
Oh yeah,
and one crashes through a young boy's window, and he's looking at a copy of Playboy, and this Playboy bunny crashes onto his bed, and he just looks up and goes, "Thank you, God!"
Oh, cheeky. The people are like running. It's really just pandemonium.
It's basically a riot. It looks like war footage.
It really does,
they're setting off smoke bombs and
just everybody's life's in danger.
Yeah, dogs it's and cats living together.
Mass hysteria.
And
it's just bonker. And of course, the dean like hates all this, and I think he like falls off his podium. And
They crash the deathmobile into the bleachers.
Exactly.
The mayor and the dean and the dean's wife and
right. It's a whole type of it's insanity.
It is.
Chip Diller, played by Kevin Bacon, he gets like trampled,
and he is totally flat like a Warner Brothers cartoon,
right? Like Judge Doom in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Picture that. He's like that. Oh, and there's also another scene earlier when he gets into the Omegas where he gets paddled, which is like a famous scene.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh, I guess.
Yep.
Which I guess is something that happens. And
I was never in a fraternity myself, so
here,
I don't. I only knew that world from a distance.
Yes.
Think a lot of the fraternities had cleaned up their acts by the 90s when I was in college.
Oh,
but
so they claim.
You know, I went to the odd party, the odd fraternity party.
Oh,
I usually enjoyed myself there.
Oh,
but,
bro, you nailed some strange. That was so unconvincing. I apologize.
I'm seeing a whole new side of you on this episode.
I bro out when I talk about bro movies.
Yeah, like, I guess so.
I smell like Axe body spray now. I was like, oh, that Entourage movie was actually pretty good. It was really good. Right, bro?
So the Deltas wreck the parade.
And then they do this thing that I kind of like where... they show what happened in the future of each of the deltas.
Right. Yeah, like, you've seen this in other movies like American Graffiti, and at the end of That Thing You Do, it says, like, right. Oh, here's what happened to this character 10, right. 15 years down the line.
Right. It showed, like, Hoover became a lawyer in Baltimore.
Yeah, public defender.
Right. Otter became, like, a gynecologist or
yes.
in Beverly Hills, of course.
Yes.
Feel up women all the live long day.
Yeah. Flounder becomes, like, a sensitivity counselor in Cleveland.
Right. Pinto, he became... the editor-in-chief at National Lampoon.
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, it shows that the Omega is like Greg. He went on to work for Nixon.
Nixon, White House aide, raped in prison, 74.
I was like, gee, that is...
That's dark. That is dark. And this, I mean, this...
A prison rape joke.
And this is like 4 years removed from Watergate. This is very fresh in the public's consciousness. Yeah. And then Niedermeyer, who is the big ROTC guy, the big military asshole...
Yeah.
It says, shot in Vietnam by his own troops.
Yeah, that's dark. I'm like, wow.
Which, by the way, has a tie-in in one of John Landis's later movies. He did a segment in the 1980-82 Twilight Zone movie. I forget which year it was.
Oh, wow.
But he has some... there's a segment in there that takes place in Vietnam, and he has some soldiers saying, like, oh, we shouldn't have fragged Niedermeyer like that.
Really?
So he has like a little in-joke in there about Niedermeyer getting killed.
Easter egg.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that's interesting.
I did not know that. Oh, wow. Okay. And of course, it says Boone and Katie, they get, like, the two of them kind of get back together. And
they reconcile.
Yeah. And then it said they got married in such and such year and divorced like 2 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, married 64, divorced 1969.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah. Yeah. You're just like, and you understand why both of those things happened.
Yeah.
Which is what I like about the Boone-Katie relationship.
Right. It says D-Day, whereabouts unknown.
He just speeds off in the car.
Yeah.
And that's the last you see of D-Day. He apparently gets away from the police.
No one knows anything about him. And of course, it shows Bluto, who's dressed up as a pirate, and he kind of takes one of the women.
He abducts Mandy, the woman he has been lusting after and creeping on for the entire movie.
And because
Mandy, as something speeds away, it rips away her dress.
Right.
Like, all the women on her float, they're dressed up like Jackie Kennedy from. Right. November 22nd, 1963. They're in that pink outfit with the pillbox hat.
Right, right.
Which,
that's
a little...
ha, ha, ha.
I mean, that's some dark overtones there.
There's a lot of dark overtones.
There are. And, so she's out there with her in her underwear, and she's trying to cover herself. And
very then, Benny Hill.
Yes, it is very Benny Hill-ish. Yeah, she's just like, oh, I have to switch my hands constantly from the top to the bottom, and how do I cover myself up? I don't die for cover. I just stand here and...
Yeah, you, like...
Constantly try to cover myself with my hands.
If you're out in the street in your underwear, you figure you'd run into a building or something to hide.
But that is what a real woman would do, most likely. In movies, women just stand in one place and just try to cover themselves with their hands. That is what they do.
That's what the women do.
Yeah. And they're spontaneously stripped in movies a lot.
Yeah, huh?
I mean, I grew up in the 80s. It happens a lot.
Homina, homina.
You know?
Yeah.
Watch the prom scene from Zapped. I mean,
my God. Zapped.
And the women in that movie, they react like no women ever who are like unexpectedly stripped naked. They're just like, oh, hey, I'm naked. Yay.
Yeah.
I mean, that is not a reaction a real person has.
They were pretty cool.
They were like,
they were cool with it.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, it's your body. Whatever, baby.
So Bluto snatches up this woman. The last shot of the movie, them driving off.
And it says he becomes like a congressman or something like that.
Yeah. Senator and Mrs. Blutarski.
Okay, yeah. Oh, and it also shows. And also another thing, Babs, because like this plays something later on. She becomes like, she works at Universal Hollywood, and she's like
a tour guide.
A tour guide.
Yes.
Which plays into something later on.
Yes.
But as far as that goes, that's pretty much the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bunch of wacky hijinks and whatnot.
It is outrageous. It is offensive, but it is so funny.
It's out there.
It is so. I mean, I love this movie. I still love this movie.
Yeah, it's out there. So with the Babs connection is after the credits, there's a scene that they show where it says, "Oh, while in California, visit Universal Studios or Universal Hollywood." And in parentheses, it says, "Ask for Babs."
And for every movie that John Landis did for Universal, he would put that at the end of the credits.
Nice, really.
And that was apparently like a real promotion that they ran at Universal Studios. If you were like buying a ticket and you said, "Oh, is Babs here?" or Can I See Babs, they would either give you a discount or they would let you in for free.
Holy, holy.
They don't do this anymore, apparently, but this was a promotion that they ran for, like, I think, into the late 80s.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool. That's a neat little Easter egg before we really had, and it was the era before DVDs or anything like that. So
far out. Oh, wow. All right. That's a nice little in joke right there.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
All right. So, I mean, and that's the movie. And like we said before, it did crazy business, buku bucks. I think this might have been the movie that, I'm trying to think if Porky's came before. This came after this, right?
This came before Porky's. All right, Porky's was like early 80s.
So then, like, this was the movie that kind of launched all the other.
This created the genre of, like, the college movie.
Right, like Revenge of the Nerds and Porky's and all that stuff.
I mean, all of those movies are, like, chasing after the sort of success that Animal House had.
It definitely felt about that's the vibe I got.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, once this made the money that it made, everybody was, like, taking notice. Like, oh, and well, we got to do that.
And it was so successful, they actually tried to get a sequel off the ground.
Right. Well, we got a tweet about that from one of our...
Oh, wow. Yeah, and there were a couple of attempts at making a sequel. Like, the same writers, they planned a sequel set in 1967, with the Summer of Love. So this would be 5 years after the first film.
Summer Lovin'.
And so the Deltas would have a reunion for Pinto's marriage in Haight-Ashbury, San Francisco, which was, Haight-Ashbury was like the epicenter of the hippie movement in the Summer of Love. And it says on the Wikipedia page, the only Delta to have become a hippie is Flounder, who is now called Pisces. Later, Chris Miller and John Weidman, another Lampoon writer, created a treatment for this screenplay, but Universal rejected it because the sequel to American Graffiti, which contained some hippie 1967 references, had not done well. And when John Belushi died in 1982, that was pretty much it. That was the end of that project.
I hear it. That makes sense. Like, if Belushi's not there, then just...
But
it's like The Doors, like when Morrison's gone, then band's gone.
Yeah, but this is interesting. I had not heard this before, and I just discovered this today. And as I was doing some research for this, there was another attempt at a sequel where Matty Simmons, who is the publisher of National Lampoon and a producer on this movie, he co-authored a script which had some of the Deltas returning to Faber College 5 years later.
Oh, okay.
After the events of the film, and there was a first draft script dated May 6, 1982, but it didn't go any further than that.
Hmm.
And this was a different attempt at the sequel. This was, let's see. Okay, here's a summary I found on filmbuffonline.com. This was like a script review.
Okay.
It's been 5 years since the brothers of Delta House wreaked havoc on the annual Faber College homecoming parade, and several members of the frat decide that it might be safe to venture back for a weekend visit to their old college haunts. Arriving, though, they are horrified at the changes that their beloved fraternity has undergone. After keeping it closed for half a decade, Dean Wormer has allowed Delta House to reopen, only to fill it with a collection of nerds and geeks, the type to never cause the problems that have been associated with the Deltas in the past. And so Boone, Otter, D-Day, Pinto, and Flounder take it upon themselves to instruct their new frat brothers in their fraternity's infamous history. They almost immediately run afoul of Wormer and the members of Omega House, led by their old nemesis, Doug Niedermeyer.
Mm.
Wormer wants to run the returning Deltas off campus before they sour filthy rich alumni Milton Vanderslag on donating more money to the college. Things escalate to the point where the Deltas enter into a bet with Vanderslag, Wormer and the Omegas, which puts the future existence of Delta House at risk. To win the bet, all they have to do is best the Omegas in 2 out of 3 competitions, contests that the Deltas aren't really suited for at all. Honestly, this sounds a lot like Revenge of the Nerds.
It sounds a lot like Revenge. Maybe they got a hold of that and be like, oh, let's just do Revenge of the Nerds. And
I'm wondering if maybe in some weird way Revenge of the Nerds grew out of this script.
I could totally see that.
Like, if they just decided to take that script and file the serial numbers off and...
Interesting. Change it just enough that it's like their own thing.
Yeah, I'm very curious now.
I wrote down another little tidbit. Tim Matheson, he went on to play Van Wilder's dad in National Lampoon's Van Wilder.
Yes!
So
And like some other... cast members had cameos in that at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think Mark Metcalf and Stephen Furst are also in Van Wilder.
Huh. Oh, that's pretty
good. Or is that in Sorority Boys?
Oh, sorority.
See, that's a problem with
sorority
these,
boys. Wow,
that's a problem with these other college movies. They all kind of blend together.
Yeah, it's
because they're not distinctive the way Animal House is.
Yeah, that's true. Sorority boys. I've told you.
See, I'm looking up the credits for the writing credits for Revenge of the Nerds. I'm not seeing Maddie Simmons' name on there, but I mean, maybe it's just a coincidental thing. I don't know,
maybe.
But that plot sounds the broad strokes of it, which is all I know because I haven't read the script, but. It sounds a lot like what became Revenge of the Nerds.
I think we uncovered something here, man.
Maybe. Who knows?
Uncover something big.
I don't want to like start rumors, and I don't want to, you don't want to accuse somebody of plagiarism or something like that.
Hey,
but
I think, guys,
what do you
guys,
think? Let us know.
Yeah,
tweet at us.
Is there a case here? Do we have a case?
Yeah.
Somebody get sued here?
Because this script was 1982. Revenge of the Nerds comes out in 1984. So
I'm just saying, follow the money.
The time, yeah, follow the money.
It goes all the way to the top.
We are the deep throat of of the Animal House 2 / Revenge of the Nerds conspiracy.
We just have like whiteboards with all types of information on it.
With string.
Red string everywhere.
Yeah, just connecting thumbtacks.
The truth is out there.
And I don't know how the string helps you make those.
It's the visual aid.
Yeah.
It helps you visually.
Yeah.
So that's the movie, and Animal House. It is some kind of something. It's still, still holds up.
It's one of the classics of comedy. It's one of the cornerstones of modern comedy.
It really did like help kind of build this new genre of crass. Like, we have American Pie to thank for it, and what else would I say? Revenge of the Nerds, Sorority Boys, like you mentioned, like pretty
old
much
school.
Old school. Oh, right, old school.
Yeah,
definitely. Like basically any movie that takes place in a college. In the 80s, came
or
from
90s
or
90s, you gotta tip your hat to Animal House.
Yeah,
somehow. This is the one.
This is
the
blueprint.
Thing.
Yeah, and I feel like after this came out, then they started doing like, oh, let's do Animal House, but in a ski lodge or Animal House in, I was gonna say like a summer camp, but maybe Meatballs is more for summer
camp. They were
camp
trying for some of that.
Yeah.
They were trying for some of that slobs versus the snobs.
Yeah, exactly.
Thing, or
but it was definitely that. This definitely helped pave the way.
I mean, just the archetypes in this movie. I mean, you just know the character types so well.
Right.
I was reading, they were talking about the writing of this movie. They were studying things like Archie comics and things to, really have the characters be archetypes that you could instantly respond to. And I think everybody can identify with this movie to some degree if you had any kind of college experience.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know? You're like, oh, yeah, I knew an Otter. I knew a Boone. I knew a...
Right.
And apparently...
No one knew a D-Day because he was just not... There.
I hope you didn't know a D-Day, because that would be frightening.
Yeah.
But
I knew a D-Day. I can't talk about it.
But
that's the movie, guys.
That's
the
movie.
That's our podcast. So, I guess we should just wrap her up.
Well, I mean, I think we could give a little teaser for next week.
Oh, yeah. Let's do that.
Because this movie was so successful, they tried to duplicate the success in other media, in television.
Television.
And they were actually all three networks, at the time.
Right.
This is an era when we only had three networks.
The big three.
All three, ABC, NBC, and CBS, they all introduced sitcoms with a college theme.
You don't say.
Yeah, and there was one called Brothers and Sisters, which was, I think, one about a, like a...
Black people?
No.
Oh.
It was
about, the other brothers.
It was about... like fraternity brothers and sorority sisters.
Okay. I thought.
It was about a college going co-ed.
Oh, all right.
And there was one called, I think I've forgotten the name of the other one. Let me see. Co-ed Fever, which is,
that is so generic.
I know, isn't it?
Co-ed Fever.
And there was another one that was called Delta House, which was a half-hour sitcom on ABC from the creators of Animal House.
Oh,
and we had several people continue from the reprise their roles from the movie. We had John Vernon as Dean Wormer. We had Stephen Furst as Flounder. We had Bruce McGill as D-Day, and James Widows as Hoover. So a decent amount of people from the movie.
Yeah, all right.
I mean, it's not like that MASH show where they only got Radar.
Never heard of it.
Yeah. and we had a young unknown by the name of Michelle Pfeiffer play a sorority girl by the name of Bombshell.
Ooh.
So and. It lasted all of 13 episodes.
So one season and
then we're out.
One and done. All right.
So I thought it would be interesting if we watched this show and talked about it next week.
We're going to deviate from our movies and get into television.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about Delta House, because it turns out all 13 episodes on YouTube.
What?
Yeah.
What? So no one's clamoring to stop that. They're just like, put it out there. Whatever.
What are you gonna do? I don't know if it's been issued on DVD or anything like that. We'll research this.
Okay. go to our libraries.
Yeah, we'll go to our extensive libraries and we'll get our computer guys on it. And
don't type the keyboard. Easy.
It's fine. It's fine. If I'm not on the wrong screen, it's fine.
You're gonna give me a heart attack. Crying out loud.
You're gonna be like a horse in a dean's office.
Exactly. They got to chainsaw me in half to get me out of here.
That's right. But that's what we're going to talk about next week.
Yes, Delta House.
So you can look up Delta House, and you can find it on YouTube, and you can watch it, and you can compare and contrast our reactions
indeed
with your own.
You can watch along with us.
That's right.
Hey.
That's right. So we got our work cut out for us this week,
because
that's 13 half hours. That's like 6.5 hours of content.
Oof. Time to binge.
All right.
Then we purge it on the microphones.
That's right. That's what we're going to do.
It sounded kind of gross, but you know what
it
I
did.
Meant.
Yeah. But,
you know what I meant.
But until then.
Until then, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Darren Credible, D-A-R-I-N Credible. Got a few shows cooking up, coming out. I don't remember them right now. But if you want to, you can go to my website, DarrenCredible.com, and find out.
Yeah, or just, follow him online.
Yeah.
And he'll let you know about him there.
I check my Twitters and Instagram, obsessively.
Yeah.
So just reach out to me. I'll get back to you.
There you go.
And as long as you're not some weirdo trying to sell me stuff or get into my bank account, I'll respond back.
All right.
Yeah.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Trumbull Comic. Mm-hmm. I'm also on Instagram. I don't post on Instagram, and yet somehow I checked this week, I have 205 followers.
How is that possible?
I have had an Instagram account for 6 months.
Okay.
I have not posted anything. You've tagged me in a few things.
I have.
I don't even know how to, can you retweet something on Instagram?
You can't. You got it down. You can't. If you download another app called Repost, you can do it.
See, this already sounds like it's
more trouble.
Way
than,
too much work.
It's more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah. So this is why I don't Instagram much stuff. I like things. I'll occasionally comment, but
right.
I somehow have never posted anything, and I have 205 followers. I don't get how this works.
They've got to be Russian bots.
They probably are.
At most, a good chunk of those.
Most likely, because I'm not that fascinating.
Oh.
Anyway, but on Twitter, I post stuff.
Yeah.
And you can follow me on there. And you can follow the SNL Nerds
yes.
Twitter account, the official SNL Nerds Twitter account, at SNL Nerds Show.
That's right. Get us follow and follow us on, or listen to us on non-productive.com, the website.
Yes.
We got a lot of interesting podcasts there. We got Side Adventures. We got, there's the Big Brother podcast, the mm-hmm. other...
The Honeymooners podcast.
Honeymooners podcast.
The Near Mint podcast.
Yes.
Check them out. There are a lot of good shows on the network, and we want to
yes.
help lift... All, yes. A rising tide lifts all boats.
That's right. Takes a village.
That's right.
And of course, Patreon. Give us some money if you can.
Yes. Yeah.
Money is always great.
Yeah. You can do that either on non-productive.com or just go to Patreon. Just look up SNL Nerds, and you can send us a little money to help bring you this wonderful content.
Absolutely.
So,
and let's wrap it up there. And thanks, guys, for listening. Toga, toga, toga.
Sure.
That's the best way I could figure out end it.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Later.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.